Skittle don't, I said, bim bop. Skittle don't, I said, bim. Skittle don't, I said, skid out and bop. Skittle don't, I said, bim bop boom.
This is the Freshman 15.
My name is Daniel Long, and I'm fireproof.
And my name's Jeremy Bear, and I'm not sure who should direct the movie version of my life, but the comic version of my life should definitely be drawn by Mike Mignola.
Well, Jeremy?
Yeah.
Should we get into it?
Yes.
What about his heart?
What about it?
Did you hurt it in any way?
I told you I didn't touch him!
His car skidded. It went off the cliff.
Did you check his heart?
It wasn't beating.
Did anything accidentally pierce it?
What's the difference? He's dead.
It makes all the difference! All the difference!
How can somebody be deader than dead?
So, Daniel, recent entertainment news, and this will probably give listeners a feel for how in advance we were recording some of these podcast episodes, because this is new news as of yesterday.
So for people, it's going to be old news.
This is going to be old news. They've recently added a new category to the Oscars. Did you see this?
Okay. I did not see this.
I don't know how to feel about it, but apparently there's a new Oscar category, okay, which surrounds quote unquote popular films.
What is this? What do you mean?
Well, this is part of the issue that people are having. Like, what is a popular film? You know, the agenda underneath the whole thing is we want to make sure that movies like Mission Impossible, Fallout, and Infinity War and that kind of thing have just as much of a chance as getting a really nice Oscar that's not like effects related or something like that.
Okay.
As your more, I don't know, art film sorts of things and independent film that tends to be the more Oscar darling-y films. So interesting though, it's just already some people are up in arms. Other people are like, oh, this is great. This is a way to level the playing field a little bit. In fact, I think even when Jeff Jensen was on our Oscar special, whatever it was, a year and a half ago now, he was talking about that tension with the Oscars. Like, you know, how's all that going to work?
So, I mean, do you remember the name of the specific category?
The only detail I'm seeing is it's called something like Outstanding Achievement in Popular Film, which is the most vague thing I can imagine.
That's so weird.
Isn't that odd?
So do you think that people who are making these quote-unquote popular films are going to be happy about that Oscar? Like, is it just that they want an Oscar? They want a category created for them?
I mean, I kind of go back to what Jeff's comment was about it, which is, you know, these frustrations from these major studios. They invest a lot and they campaign a lot for these major films to be recognized at the Oscars, and clearly not just a lot of money, but terrific amounts of care goes into these films, and it feels like they get brushed off come Oscar season because, you know, number one, it feels almost schlocky to vote for them. And number two, these things tend to come out at summertime and that stuff gets forgotten in summertime. This is all completely my speculation, by the way. I don't really know. But it sort of brought me back around to when we decided to do the episode that we're doing tonight. It was heavily weighted by the fact that tonight's director is, quite frankly, the big Oscar winner of the year.
Oh, yeah. Massive.
Yeah. Of course, we're talking about Guillermo del Toro.
I mean, in his film, Shape of Water, I can't remember the amount, but he took home the Oscars in most of the major categories.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, anyone who's heard our Oscar special this year, which, again, sadly, Daniel, you were not able to
Try to rub it in. I'm sorry.
Again, it's on you.
But, I know it is. It's my fault.
But that was my pick. Shape of Water was and still is my favorite film of 2017. I loved Shape of Water unapologetically. Nevertheless, it was Guillermo del Toro's year.
It's totally his year.
It just really, really felt like, well, there's no better time than now to put him on the roster. And so here we are.
And talking about his freshman film, Kronos, 1993 film. But I have a really long history with del Toro.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because he's a filmmaker that I have loved and appreciated for a long time.
Now, is this partly because of your own Mexican heritage?
It's not necessarily, but it's interesting that you bring that up because there are parts of kind of the things that he explores, or at least some of the components of his films that I think we'll talk about later on that do connect. He just does something with film that I think is so unique Yeah. And certainly unique among the directors that we've talked about. And we see it right off the bat with Kronos. But had you seen, you hadn't seen Kronos before this?
No, and I think it's also important to point out, because this was also one of my hidden agendas with picking Guillermo del Toro, is we have never before now discussed a foreign language film.
I know, that's right.
Which is, I'm not going to call it a crime, you know, but it's something that I really was hoping we would get to here in the season two. And yeah, we're getting toward the end here, but it was exciting, kind of cool. I'm not going to speak for both of us, but I engage a foreign language film slightly different than I do other films. And it's hard to put my finger on what exactly is different about that engagement, but I tend to prepare my own intellect, I guess, more and differently for something that's a foreign language film, because if it's not, on some level at least, kind of an intellectual experience, I find that, well, why else do you watch a foreign language film?
You know? Okay, so you want that to be there. You want it to have some sort of connection to ideas or...
Ideas or just, you know, I want to walk away. If I'm going to read a movie
I was going to ask that question, yeah.
Yeah, then I think I'm wanting to be able to take some sort of deeper something out of it. It's just, it's weird. I know that sounds silly, but it almost feels like if you're going to make me work this hard, for a movie, then I want to walk away with something substantial. You know, I want it to be a meal instead of just a snack. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you're half Mexican. Mm-hmm. Did mom watch Spanish television, Spanish films, or I should say Spanish spoken films or anything like that? Was that part of your childhood that you were more exposed to that, or was that not really a thing?
So soap operas were massive.
No kidding.
With my nana. I mean, that's what I referred to her as. So my grandmother. All form of soap operas. This would include American soap operas, telenovelas, of course. That was a part of my growing up. Those were some of the first things I actually remember watching.
Oh, wow.
Was this kind of melodramatic acting, right? But for some reason, I was intrigued by it. Mm-hmm. You know, it got me, which says something, I think, about the type of work that they're doing, that it can hold the attention span of, from as young as a person can remember, that's when I remember, like, watching these things. My nana would have it on all the time. It was just something that was happening in the background. She'd have the specific ones that she'd want to watch. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, with that type of thing, there's one that's coming on later. There were no subtitles. Like, I would just hear it.
Yeah.
And so my mom is Mexican and my dad is white. And I actually grew up mostly with my dad. So I didn't really learn Spanish.
Okay.
I'm really disappointed about. But my nana would watch me during the day.
Right.
Occasionally. So it was such an interesting thing to have been watching something I wasn't understanding. But I think because of it's a soap opera format, I still understood kind of what was happening.
Right. It was almost a pantomime of drama.
Yeah.
That was one of the things that even recently in watching Kronos for the first time, that was sort of sticking out to me a little bit because, yeah, I'll admit it, I do associate Mexican entertainment, not just, you know, film and TV, but even music and all that with this sort of thing that I don't always respond to as well, coming from a different cultural place where, yeah, to my eyes and my ears, sometimes it does feel a little overdone. And we live in, our neighborhood is mostly Latino. And from houses, surrounding houses, we'll hear mariachi music and that kind of thing all the time playing. And I'll be honest, I hate it. I mean,
you don't like it.
I have nothing against people that are into that music. I hear it and it's grating to me. It's so big and it's so, you know, I don't know. It's just overblown and obvious and all that. And it just feels, and like I say, and I'm not saying the music is childish, but with my cultural background, that's how it hits my ears, you know, and there's really nothing I can do about that. I just, you know, I wind up shutting the windows like, I can't listen to this music anymore. But I feel like there's a personality to a lot of Mexican entertainments that, like I said, for someone like me and my background, it does hit me as really overblown, which is why I'm so intrigued by some of the more subtle points of something like Kronos.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, I even heard Guillermo del Toro talk about his lead actor, fantastic, powerful performance, but so subtle. Mm-hmm. And there's long stretches of the movie that Guillermo del Toro specifically wrote to be without dialogue for that reason, because he wanted to kind of counteract what was maybe so popular in the culture to just to do these big dramatic things. And he said, no, let's see if we can go a different direction with it, which I appreciated.
And to hear you say that is really fascinating, because I think he's done that with acting. He's just transferred, though, the tendency that I think is inherent in Latino drama into something like fantasy.
Right.
And set design.
Oh yeah.
And color,
because it is very big and ornate. And
yes, and so he does have that tension. So he's such a Mexican filmmaker.
Yeah,
you can't get around that. It's just how he's chosen to maybe use and channel those sensibilities, which I think makes him an artist that is certainly just an incredibly unique voice.
Yeah,
you can't really distill one of his films into something like a premise. To talk about his films, to say this is what's happening, there's so many things that you can't see.
Yeah.
Right?
That we have to go through that cultural portal first.
Yes. It's just so, yeah, I think it's such a cool thing that here we are talking about some of these things that are like, I think are so inherent to a Guillermo del Toro film. When I think about his films and someone says, what's that film about? And it's a Guillermo del Toro film, I almost want to talk about what it looks like and some of the things that you'll see instead of, oh, this is a film about this, and this.
It's secondary, what it's actually about. It's the way he's bringing you through what it's about is the important thing.
And I love that.
Well, let's talk about that. So, Kronos, freshman film, 1993, Guillermo del Toro. What's Kronos about?
So, Kronos is about this. Also interesting, so there's a prologue to the film. Mm. What you learn in this prologue is there's this alchemist, I think in the 16th century, who discovers a way or creates something in order to help him live long.
Right? A device.
It's a device. And you actually don't know much about it, and you don't know how it works. You just know it's a device. And this man, early on in the film, in the prologue, he dies, and it's maybe 400 years later,
right,
where this man dies. The device isn't found, but it's in this statue that is found, right? And it winds up in this antique shop owned by Jesus Gris, Jesus Gray. There's this other plot going on where there's this man who is sick. I can't remember his first name, but last name, De La Guardia. He's looking for this device because he's sick. He wants to live long life. He has Ron Perlman plays his
flunky,
his muscle to kind of just go out and try to get it.
Right.
In between this time, Jesus and his granddaughter, Aurora, discover the device, keep it. He uses it. That creates this struggle between Jesus, De La Guardia, and Aurora. His granddaughter is involved in all of that.
It definitely does center around this Jesus character, essentially this old antique shop owner who comes across a device that bestows the user with immortality and everything that falls out of that. It's sort of this slow realization, at least it was for me. It's following all the rules of a vampire story.
Which was totally cool and surprised me completely.
Yeah, this is my question for you. When was the moment you realized that this was a vampire story?
I had suspicions in the moment when he is in the refrigerator.
Right.
So this is the first time, right? He's super thirsty. He drinks the water. I didn't associate that at all with being a vampire.
Right.
But then there's a raw meat.
Right, bloody meat.
Bloody meat. You see that he wants it.
Yeah, he's clearly tempted.
It's odd to him that he wants it. He's not really sure why.
Yeah.
So that kind of raised the antenna. I was like, oh. But I didn't think of it as following the rules yet.
Right.
It wasn't until, which is one of my favorite scenes, and we need to get there, is when he's licking the blood off the floor.
Yeah. Not just your favorite scene, but also Guillermo del Toro's favorite scene. In fact, he's even said he, in some ways, made the movie for that scene.
Oh my gosh, it's such an incredible scene. So this scene really takes place in this party or something's going on. He's at this party with his wife and his granddaughter. A man has a bloody nose, and all of a sudden Jesus sees it, and you can just tell that, like, all of a sudden he's jonesing.
Yeah.
And the man walks to the bathroom. He follows him to the bathroom. He sees, like, this puddle of blood on the sink, and the man leaves after he cleans up, and Jesus is totally disappointed, and then he sees him on the floor.
He sees some of the blood on the floor.
And the scene takes its time.
Oh, yeah.
For Jesus to get on the floor, to look at the blood, and to lick it slowly off of the floor.
Off of a bathroom floor, yeah.
It's so good.
I look at certain moments and I love them and I marvel and I go, that's beautiful, that's still beautiful. I love the scene where he licks the blood from the bathroom. I think is really beautiful and very nicely staged, and I have great admiration for what we did with what we have.
Oh, it's so hard to not just immediately dig into these details. I want to come back to this. First time you saw Kronos, was it recently or had you seen this a while ago?
No, I hadn't seen this a while ago. This is the first time I'd seen it within the last 2 weeks.
Okay, okay.
I'd heard about it. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like this, oh yeah, I should get to that at some point. So I was really grateful for the opportunity to need to see it.
Yeah.
And so is it the same for you?
Same, yeah. And intriguing to see how much was already Guillermo del Toro, quite frankly. If you're familiar with the films of Guillermo del Toro, then you know that there are certain things that you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get a movie in which either the star or one of the stars of the show is going to be some creature of some sort.
Yes, creatures. He loves creatures.
Has he ever made a movie in which there are no creatures? It's what he's all about.
No. Every movie has a creature.
Every movie. Every movie is meticulously art directed from a set design standpoint. They're all very ornate.
Mm-hmm.
The camera moves are both elaborate, but so just buttery. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't have another word for it, but it's just everything is so glidey and smooth and perfect. And the rack focusing is always at just the right perfect moment. And you just have this camera that moves you through the story. The edits, they're not slow, but also not fast. They take their time. It's almost over perfect. Mm-hmm. I don't even want to say that because it's not. It's Guillermo del Toro, but he has such a solid sense of what the camera and what the art direction and what the actors and what everything that should be happening at any given moment. It's like he's seen the whole movie in his head. I don't know if this is true. This might be a complete fabrication. I read somewhere that he has a photographic memory.
Mm.
By the way, a terrific artist and illustrator, if you've ever seen.
Yeah, he draws a lot of his own stuff, right? I mean,
beautiful, beautiful. And in fact, I think it's become one of the themes of this season of the Freshman 15 is directors that are also illustrators for some reason.
But I wonder why that's a theme.
Who knows? But you can just see and just, you know, the materials that he puts together that, you know, he has thought about every last detail and so meticulous. I don't even know another word for it. He's just so meticulous in the use of every single color and every single texture and everything you see on the screen. It's all Guillermo. Anyway, I didn't mean to launch into all that. But
no, but it's good. Have you heard about his house?
No.
Okay. So his house apparently has a name. I think it's Bleak House, which is a Dickens reference. But so every room, I want to say every room, the majority of rooms have certain themes.
Yeah.
He has like thousands upon thousands of books, comic books.
I did hear that.
Magazines.
Yeah. Right.
But they're like, I can't remember, it was an insane number of libraries dedicated to certain people. So like H.P. Lovecraft would have his own room.
Whole room.
Yeah, just Frankenstein. That film was like a big influence on him. So right. He'd have like the chair that was used in the movie.
Right.
You know, in one of these rooms. And after he makes a film, he almost creates like a tableau of that film from different pieces of the sets that he wants to remember and costumes and things. So that connects to exactly what you're saying, is that he, like his life is an aesthetic in a sense. And that is how he makes a film.
Yeah.
Everything matters.
Yeah. Everything matters. That's such a great way to sum up Guillermo del Toro's artwork is when you look at it. Now, I don't know how you felt about The Shape of Water. I would be surprised if you were as taken with it as I was.
I did like it a lot. I don't think I wasn't as taken with it as you were.
Yeah, but I think that's a perfect example of that. It's just like every color and every moment and every, you know, Richard Jenkins with all of his pies and, mm-hmm. you know, all that kind of, every little moment, it's so rich and juicy. And even if the story itself isn't necessarily this complex study of something, it's just, he's just giving you such a rich meal mm-hmm. to enjoy every time. And, he makes it look so easy, and yet when I stop and think about it, I think, oh, holy cow, that looks hard to do.
Right.
And it's both of these things happening at once because he sends you on this journey with every film. The journey sort of takes itself. You're just, you know, you can't help it. You're swept up in all of that.
You are. I mean, you think about Kronos in how some of the different set pieces are so remarkably constructed. You can tell the colors picked. I'm thinking of De La Guardia's lair. I mean, that's what it feels like, or this place where he's living, right? Gray. Everything is so gray, industrial, and you just kind of it feels like it's dying, which is juxtaposed to the party where he's at, which is, right, you know, lush colors, even his room and the walls and Aurora's hideout on the roof. I mean, it's just so many. Sure. You just tell like that everything is telling part of the story that is so Del Toro. And we've talked about this with like Wes Anderson,
sure,
you know, and where you can just hit pause anywhere. And all, there's so much to just consider.
Yeah.
And it's going to tell you something about the movie.
Yeah. I can't say that I love all of his movies, though.
Right.
That's the thing that's interesting. I love looking at all of his movies. And there are some of his movies, everything about it I love. Shape of Water, definitely. Pan's Labyrinth. Oh, my goodness. I mean, just...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
One of the most gorgeous things, most definitely. Others, I can't say that they're ugly movies, but I just... I'll straight up say it. I really disliked actively Pacific Rim.
Right.
I just thought it was a bad movie, yeah, quite frankly. And as much as I love the source material, I don't really care for the Hellboy movies.
You don't?
They don't really do it for me, no. I feel like they're kind of muddled.
Okay.
I know where he's pulling these things from because I love the Hellboy comics and all that. As movies, though, I look at them and I'm like, I see why you're doing that. I don't. It's not drawing me in, huh, frankly.
I really loved Hellboy. I didn't actually see the Golden Army, but first one I loved.
Yeah, I wouldn't go so far as to say that they're bad. It feels like a lot of dressing and not a lot underneath with Hellboy.
He lied to us.
Hey, bull buddy, can we ever get out of this? We gotta talk.
But I wonder if there's something there where it's the more commercially and blockbustery or something. I don't think that's his sweet spot, personally. Mm-hmm. I think his sweet spot are personal films.
Mm-hmm.
That's an easy thing to say, I guess. You know, I mean, yeah, of course, anyone's going to say, yeah, an artist's best work is his most personal work. I don't personally agree with that. I think there's lots of exceptions to that. In Guillermo's case, I think it is actually true, though. I think the stuff that's the most personal to him is some of his most interesting things. And even though I don't think it's his best movie, I would actually include Kronos in that. I was very intrigued,
mm-hmm,
and very interested and very drawn in by Kronos.
So I'm wondering if there's a thread here, and I wanted to talk about this, and this seems like a good place. You like the films that most closely resemble something like the fairy tale.
Maybe.
Or the...
folk tale.
The folk tale. Right? I mean, I think that's kind of a thread I'm seeing from Kronos,
mm-hmm,
to Pan's Labyrinth to Shape of Water.
Yeah.
I mean, these are the films that he's doing something specific with.
Yeah.
And I guess that's one of the questions I had. And Kronos certainly is that. I mean, here's a tale about something that promises immortality.
Right.
And the potential costs involved in something like eternal life. Yeah, what is that? I mean, yeah, it can probably be connected to his culture. I mean, that's a big part of Latin culture, these kind of larger stories, these other worlds that are kind of constantly connected to even the real world. But I think he's also using that in some very intentional ways. So that was one of the questions I had is, Why do you think he's choosing to tell stories that way?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. At the end of Kronos, you see that he's dedicated the film to his grandmother. I don't know if you got the chance to listen to the director commentary of Kronos.
I didn't.
Man.
It's good?
It's really good, but I have to tell you, I think that if I had to pick a director that I could just sit for hours and just listen to his voice, it would be Guillermo del Toro.
Awesome.
He's got the most beautiful voice.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I've heard him with interviews. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. This guy, I'll be honest, I kind of dropped off to sleep listening to the commentary, and I had to start it again, you know, the next morning because he just has the most wonderful, soothing voice.
Hmm.
But if you listen to the commentary, and you know, I know we usually do this at the end, but I'm just going to say it right now. Filmstruck
has all of it right there.
Yeah, not just Kronos available to watch on Filmstruck, but also if you want, you can listen to it with director's commentary on, which is a great commentary track. So insightful and really, really interesting. But he talks about that, yes, he dedicated this film to his grandmother, who was actually an abusive woman.
Oh, wow.
As you come to find out, he describes her as an amped up Piper Laurie from Carrie, mm-hmm. ultra hyper religious
wow.
to an abusive. He describes how she would do things like describe in detail to him, like as a 6-year-old, all the tortures of hell.
Wow.
Also, she would do things like she would stick bottle caps in his shoes.
Dang.
Before he would go to school, and he would have to walk to school with bottle caps in his shoes that would cut his feet. And she would say she was doing it to remind him of the suffering of Christ. Things like that. I mean, you know, you hear these things and you're like, oh my gosh, this woman should be in prison or something. Hmm. But Guillermo del Toro describes the love he has for her. And he, you know, he admits, he said, yes, she had problems. And yeah, there were these abuses and stuff. He said, but I can't escape the affection that I had for this woman, mm-hmm. this passionate woman.
I love the very ending. I always cry at the end because it's a movie I dedicated to my grandmother. Because ultimately the relationship between the granddaughter and the grandfather was very much based on the sort of acceptance and love that I learned from loving my grandmother.
And he talks about the fact that these things, the blood, the suffering, seeing her on her deathbed and, you know, trying to wrestle with, you know, if she could go on, would it be worth it for a person like this mm-hmm. to go on and things like that? All these were ingredients that went into the recipe that was Kronos.
Yeah.
And you can see parallels going over,
absolutely.
Like De La Guardia and, you know, all that and, you know, the blood and full of religious imagery all that. In fact, and I'm sorry, it's just I was so intrigued by the things in this commentary track.
Oh, that's so fascinating.
He describes how in the 60s there was this fad, and it was for Mexican women. They would do a thing where they would capture live insects and gild these insects in gold and wear them as jewelry. And he says he remembers being a little boy in the late 60s and seeing this, like these women with what he imagined to be inside this gold, these living insects mm-hmm. inside these like lockets or necklaces or something like that, because it was just this cool thing to do for some reason. And that stuck with him. And it just, you know, and the idea of this gilded device with a living insect inside of it that had this sort of
filtering power. It's like a filtering power. What was it?
Yeah, exactly. But and that's what you come to find out in the movie, that, you know, oh wow, this is, you know, this is the thing that it sort of filters blood through it, and that's what gives people this immortality and also the curse of vampirism and that kind of thing. And so just all these different ingredients went into this script that he wrote. I want to say he was like 22, 23 when he mm-hmm. wrote the script, didn't make the film until he was 28. It might just seem like this weird sort of vampire-y story on the surface, but when you get underneath all that, it's the story of Guillermo del Toro's childhood.
Absolutely. And here's the thing about Latino culture. Nothing trumps familial relationships. Mm. Nothing.
Abuse or no abuse.
Oh, right. I mean, loyalty, staying connected is such a high value.
Right.
My mom has put up with so much. I mean, all of my aunts and uncles have, but certainly, I mean, I'm closest to my mother. And so I know all the things that she's put up with. And I've talked to her about it. Like, you don't have to take that. You can say no. You can walk away. You're stronger than that. Like, these are things I've said to her.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating because here I am half Hispanic, but yet grew up primarily white. So that part of my life isn't the part that guides me most, right? It's this kind of individualism that I'd say probably guides me more than the familial aspect of what it means to be a part of like the Latino culture.
Yeah.
And so I miss out on the benefits of that maybe, or just kind of the struggle of that. But when I think of Aurora, right, who might be a stand-in for Guillermo del Toro in the film, you can see her standing by her grandfather, who is turning into a vampire,
right,
and doing some things that as a child you would never want to witness.
Horrific.
Absolutely horrific. But yet she's there. And yeah, she stays committed the whole time.
Willing to even offer the blood of her fingers to right, her grandfather.
But that's part of it. And so when I hear Guillermo del Toro like still having affection for this woman,
yeah,
who's done these horrendous things, to him, I would imagine there's just no other way.
Yeah.
It wasn't even that he was probably like trapped or locked in, or that was his grandmother.
Yeah. I mean,
why wouldn't he still have affection for her?
Yeah. And that's definitely not a story that we as contemporary Americans in Southern California, we don't have a version of that.
No, we do not. That's right. But I'd never thought of Aurora's connection or relationship with Jesus being in contradiction to the relationship between De La Guardia and Ron Perlman's character.
Mm.
You know, here's Ron Perlman, who's so freaking pissed that he's needing to do the things that his uncle's asking him to do.
Right.
Cursing him under his breath, he calls, he's like, oh, what does this guy need? And then he'll say, oh, what do you need? You know?
Right.
Fuck!
Of flesh and mind.
Yes, Uncle.
Get up here immediately.
Motherfucking cocksucking son of a bitch, asshole Pendejo.
I want to know what happened.
You're right there.
Shit. But it just, I wonder, like, is that an intentional contrast? Is that what Del Toro's possibly doing? I mean, in this conversation, I think it seems really intentional.
Yeah, I mean, that was one thing that was remarkable to me, whether it's the grandfather and the granddaughter, Ron Perlman or the De La Guardia relationship, even going farther down the line, the pissed off morgue employee,
mm-hmm,
who has to deal with this body and all that. Everyone seems like they're putting up with more shit than they should have to.
Yes.
In a way. But finally, I just had to come around to being like, I guess putting up with shit, is that just part of Mexican culture maybe? And
yeah.
I'm not really, you know, it's just something that I don't have a direct ability to relate to. Or...
Right. I think that's right. And I don't think they'd say, oh, we're putting up with shit.
Yeah, but we would.
Oh, absolutely. We look at that and think, oh, yeah, why would you be doing that?
Yeah.
And to them, it's like they can't conceive of another way of what it means to be a person.
Right.
Connected to another person.
Yeah. It, by the way, while we're on the topic, I love that morgue guy.
Oh, dude, he's one of my favorite characters.
What a great performance and what a great character.
He looked good. Yeah.
He had a whole sort of musicality to him and all that. And I was just, I don't know. It's just, there are all these little moments all throughout Kronos. Again, I don't think it's Guillermo's strongest film, but he filled it with so many nice, cool, interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed going from one scene to the next. I know I asked you earlier, what was the moment that you first knew this was a vampire story? Mm-hmm. It sounds like you were a little wiser than me, because it took me a lot longer to figure it out. It wasn't until the streaks of light were going through the holes in the attic burned him that I was like, oh, what is he, a vampire? Which is like toward the end of the film.
And he's like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, like Dracula or something. I was like, oh, yeah, that's what you're doing there. So interesting. Also intriguing that the color is so intentional, mm-hmm, throughout the whole film. Loved the fact that whether we're talking about the alchemist or even Jesus after he's had his quote-unquote resurrection on the third day.
Right.
Very intentional. Mm-hmm. You know, he's peeling off this, I don't know, some sort of like, whether it's plasticine or something from his face and his body.
Yeah.
And you see the white skin, yep, underneath. Stark, stark white. You know, from there to the bathroom, just like whenever. I notice whenever you see blood, you really see blood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that bathroom is a perfect example. Guillermo del Toro just kind of bashes your brains out with it, with a color.
Right.
So, you know, you look at the party is all black and white and also blues. He just knows what he wants you to look at.
For example, in the color coding of the movie, we say no to red, except with whatever is related to blood or life. So the granddaughter has a very bright red coat, and the blood in the plate of meat is in the middle of a blue refrigerator, you know? Or everything in the party, in the New Year's party, is in blue, white, golden, but very few warm colors, no red. The bathroom is perfect black and white with one red splash of blood. And that's supporting the rarity of the blood and the desirability and the sort of life impulse that blood is going to have for a character that lives his life really void of that.
I rewatched Mimic.
Oh, you did?
The sophomore film.
Okay.
I got to tell you, I was so impressed.
You were?
I really was.
Okay, I didn't need to expect go back to and be. Watch it.
And Guillermo del Toro talks about it as his least favorite film that he's ever done. And I think part of it is all the stress that was surrounding that film and all that. He's so upfront about it. The film, of course, was done with Miramax. Mm-hmm. And he is completely upfront about the fact that after that experience, he refused to ever work with the Weinsteins again.
Wow.
In particular, Harvey Weinstein was just such an asshole, which, you know, I guess we can say freely now.
Seems true.
But just arbitrary artistic decisions that were forced on him. And he was just in complete misery during all of Mimic.
Wow.
But when you look at it, I would challenge you to go back to Mimic. Just purely from a craft perspective, it's kind of flawless visually.
Wow.
I'm not talking about the plot or anything like that or the dialogue. Just purely from a, you know, how's the storytelling of the film? For the time it was made, it's just one of the better things from that whole era. Like if I'm talking about just visually. Now, yeah, all the other stuff and all the story wonkiness and all that, unfortunately, kicks it way back down the ladder. And that's a shame. Because he really had the makings of a very, very, one of the great films it could have been, I think.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah.
It's the blood! The smell of the blood is driving them crazy!
Oh, shit!
We have to cover the set! Give me a razor! Give me a razor! Here, take it. Rub it on the windows, anywhere where there's a crack.
What?
Just do it!
Come on!
So I'm intrigued by one of the things you said in terms of the body horror part, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the blood, the skin. He is such a master at reminding, even though encased in these like fantastical fairy tale films, that there's reality. And one of the ways he does that, I think, is through bodies.
Sure.
And I'm thinking of the moment when Jesus is peeling apart his, like you said, his stomach area, right?
Right.
Where he's pulling that apart. I think of The Shape of Water, one of the scenes that was just so horrific and hard to watch, but I thought was such an amazing moment, was the fingers. And then Michael Shannon, after having shot the doctor in the face, putting his hand in his mouth, and dragging him, right? Putting one finger through the hole of where the bullet went through.
Yeah.
And dragging him. Guillermo del Toro, I don't think does horror just for the sake of like, oh, this is so gross, right?
Yeah.
But he's constantly like pulling you back to the fact that like we're human beings with.
Yeah.
And I love that so much. In a world where he could just kind of screw all of that.
Yeah.
Like none of this actually matters because he wants to just continually blend those things together.
Oh, yeah.
And that's how he does it.
And you can't not talk about it, of course, because it's the metaphor. We flopped the relationship.
Oh,
now
yeah.
He's the fish.
Yes.
That he's being fish hooked back into
absolutely.
His...
Oh, absolutely.
And it's the kind of thing that Guillermo does. And he does it really well. And I know there's people that complain about these bash you over the head metaphors and those kinds of... If they're done well, I'm all about it. And that's another reason that I love Shape of Water. But now sometimes they're obscure. And sometimes they're just in a big neon sign right in front of your face, flashing, flashing, flashing. But Guillermo is intentional about literally everything, even if it only makes sense to him. He doesn't just do things because, maybe that would be interesting. No, he knows. He has some obscure passage in some book that he read years ago that's the reason for doing some tiny detail, some tiny corner of something. And there's something about the quality of these films, you kind of feel it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's not working for me, even if it's something, like I said, on the level of a Pacific Rim, or even for me, you know, like Hellboy or something, it's all still there, though. And he's making these really intentional decisions. Important to point out, when you look at trivia about Guillermo del Toro, you'll also see the long list of films that he's turned down.
Oh,
over
wow.
the years, or gotten involved with and you know, made another choice or something like that. Probably the most famous in, you know, whatever, in the last decade or so has to be he was going to be the Peter Jackson mm-hmm. of the Hobbit trilogy.
Yeah, I remember that.
Which wasn't even a trilogy, I think, when he was involved. And quite frankly, the fact that it became a trilogy, I think, was maybe one of the downfalls of that movie. Mm-hmm. But it was just, it was too little story and too much movie, you know?
Right.
But yeah, he was going to be, and he decided, no, I've got this passion project. It's called Pacific Rim. And so he moved away from the Tolkien franchise and went over to Pacific Rim. And you know what? Whatever. God bless him. I couldn't stand the movie. But another case, though, where you have to admit, holy cow, it is a gorgeous movie, though.
Oh, it's gorgeous. And he's committed to the whole, to the thing all the way through.
Yeah, absolutely. But it was something that, and it was something I wanted to ask you about. And if you don't agree with me on this, like some of his movies are bad and some of them are amazing, then you probably won't have a lot to say about it. That is my feeling, though.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? What is it that makes Guillermo del Toro take a story, a script like Pacific Rim, something as hacky and overblown and just, quite frankly, just the whole movie to me was just such a big eye roll. How does that guy also make Pan's Labyrinth,
mm-hmm.
which is just so incredibly rich and intelligent and works on all these amazing and subtle levels? Like, how is the same guy responsible for both those movies? I honestly don't know. I don't know if you have an idea about it.
I mean, here's my stab at it, because I've thought about that. I think he's not just concerned with the visuals and putting everything he can into a frame. And I think he's actually concerned with saying something important.
Okay.
I think with Kronos, you know, you have like this greed, right, for time, for immortality. But there's this denial of death when you find something that might promise eternal life. You actually begin to forget the life that you actually have and maybe the people around you. And so I think he's concerned. That might be one of the things he's concerned with in Kronos. These other films, I think with Pan's Labyrinth, wow, here's a story about a young girl who has greater access to what it means to have humanity
right.
than all the people around her.
Certainly than the adults around her. Oh, yeah,
absolutely. I think it's pretty obvious in The Shape of Water of what's kind of going on there. Pacific Rim, I wonder if one of the things that kind of he was excited about, I kind of see like an immigration idea there.
Okay.
These things, right, these aliens attempting to infiltrate the place and then people trying to stop that, like, and trying to build, I think, aren't they trying to build a wall or something? I don't know. I'm having a hard time finding the plot, and I don't want to like put myself in a position where I'm trying to defend that movie, because I agree with you.
Yeah.
I don't think it lives up to the rest of his films.
Right.
But I'm wondering if there's something there that he's attempting to convey about this idea of people, you know, this kind of external thing that people don't understand attempting to come in and trying to keep that out, and the kind of all the havoc that's wreaked as a result of that.
Yeah.
Again, maybe it's far-fetched. I don't know.
But then that brings me to like, but if that's the case, then it makes it even more of a head-scratcher for me personally.
But see, my thing with Del Toro movies and why I love him as a filmmaker is I can't help but think, okay, what is he trying to say here?
Yeah.
Like everything seems like it means something. Like it's supposed to at least mean something. And I feel like he has trained me to think that way.
Yeah.
Like, I'm supposed to ask that question.
Do you feel that way with Hellboy?
No, I mean, with Hellboy, I think it was, well, I mean, I think one of the things is this idea of somebody who's completely discounted as evil because of where he's come from and perhaps, you know, isn't.
Right.
Or at least his redemption is possible for even a character like Hellboy.
Right.
I understand what you don't like about me. I do. What I am makes you feel a little out of place out there.
Brad, I don't...
Listen. I can promise you two things. One, I'll always look this good. And two, I'll never give up on you.
I mean, I don't know. I feel like I'm reaching.
No,
but I love that. I like to do that with movies, and yeah. I feel like he gives me kind of freedom to do that.
Yeah. Okay, here's another one I want you to explain to me, because I don't get it. And I apologize. I don't get the appeal of Ron Perlman. I think that he has this awesome character face. A photo of him, you're like, oh, this guy's going to be great. and then he starts speaking or something, and I don't get it.
And you discount him?
I don't get what's great about him. I've never seen a performance from him where I'm just like, well, he really nailed that one. I think he nails it when he's standing there and not talking, because he looks amazing.
Right.
He looks like the greatest character actor ever, and then he starts acting, and it falls apart. Again, that's just me. It's not just with Guillermo movies either. It's every movie he's in. I look at it, and I'm scratching my head.
I can't help you with that one. You want me to explain Ron Perlman?
Explain Ron, but do you like Ron Perlman?
You know, honestly, I don't feel like I have a lot of interaction with Ron Perlman beyond Del Toro films. Like, I honestly don't.
Well, he's in, like, Jeunet films and...
Yeah, that's right. That's true, but...
Is that his deal? He's in a lot of foreign language films as the American guy? Maybe that's something. Is he the picture of America that other countries have? Ooh.
You discovered it.
I'm wondering, man.
No, maybe.
Is that weird?
If that's the case, I'm screwed.
Oh, man, we're in big trouble, right?
Yeah.
By the way, I have heard, and I want to say this, that Ron Perlman, as a guy... And I heard that this was the case with his relationship with Guillermo del Toro, even on Cronos, that he was a really stand-up guy.
Nice.
Apparently, at one point, Guillermo was in breach in terms of the amount he was able to pay him. Ron Perlman's agent said to Ron Perlman, get off the set. You're done. They're not paying blah, 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 union this and that. And he said, no, I believe in this guy, and I'm going to hang around. Stand-up thing to do.
That's cool.
Yeah, really, really great. So I'm not saying he's a bad guy. I'm just saying I don't. In terms of like acting and all that, I don't get it.
What's the deal with Ron Perlman?
What's the deal with Ron Perlman?
I mean, I thought he was fine in this film. I will say, in terms of maybe what Del Toro would do differently now than he did in Cronos, one of the things I think he's gotten so good at is character development.
Yeah.
And in particular, supporting characters. Because I don't feel like there was a lot of depth to the Perlman character.
Right.
I don't feel like there was even a lot of depth to the De La Guardia character.
Right.
Probably, if I'm now thinking about it, I would have loved to know more about Aurora. You kind of go through his films, and I feel like he kind of gets better at that.
Yeah.
I mean, in Pan's Labyrinth, I don't feel like I just got to know the girl. There's also kind of a love story going on, which I felt like connected to. Certainly, we go all the way to The Shape of Water. I mean, Richard Jenkins' character is unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
In that film.
Fantastic.
And I didn't need to be.
Yeah.
In the sense of, he was telling a story about these two characters who had no place.
Right.
And found themselves.
Yeah.
And Richard Jenkins is also that type of character, but he didn't need to be that good. And he was so incredible.
If I spoke about it, if I did, what would I tell you? What I tell you about her? The princess without voice. Or perhaps I would just warn you about the truth of these facts. And the tale of love and loss. And the monster who tried to destroy it all.
And maybe because I saw them so close together, I noticed those differences. But to go from his very first film to his very last.
Right.
And even the Michael Shannon character, I feel like even though he was a villain, I got to know way more about him. Like, I felt connected to them in a way that these other extant characters in Cronos, I don't know. I mean, the wife felt like she was just kind of there. Right? I mean,
yeah.
Everyone else kind of felt a little bit one-noted.
Well, you know, one thing that I've noticed, and I even jotted this down, is like, I think a theme that Guillermo returns to is silence is strength. I think we see that all the way back to Cronos, never more clearly and obviously than in Shape of Water. The strongest characters in the film are the most silent.
Yeah.
But I think he does this even all the way back in Cronos. I think Jesus, he's strongest when he's not speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, he has very little to say throughout the movie, and I think that's intentional. The daughter, the granddaughter, Aurora.
She barely says anything.
Yeah, if she speaks at all, it's barely anything. And essentially, it's that same character, the Aurora character, again, in Pan's Labyrinth.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
In fact,
they
she
almost
looks
look
the same.
I would say she looks
they almost
the
look
same.
Identical. But again, you know, it's silence. Silence is strength. Is that something that Guillermo del Toro is saying? Meanwhile, the idiots and the scoundrels are extremely verbose mm-hmm. in his movies.
And have the quote-unquote wisest things to say.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely the case in Kronos. You look at the captain in Pan's Labyrinth, the speeches from Michael Shannon in Shape of Water and all that. They're just, you know, what are you going to say? Full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. I think he really likes that. I think he likes that contrast. I think he successfully presents that as wisdom, actually, in his films. The wisdom of silence, honestly. Especially when you have so much that's so lush to look at. And camera work that's so gorgeous and fluid. And to sort of juxtapose that with these wise, strong, silent characters. Mm-hmm. To me, that adds up to Guillermo del Toro.
I think that's right. I mean, I even thinking of the wisdom literature right in the Bible, I mean, be slow to speak.
Sure.
That's totally there. But it's interesting. I wonder, given his upbringing from a grandmother who is so steeped in the perhaps institutionalized religious life that he's even privy to, or at least was as a kid, that here you have people who are talking, and yet whose lives don't match up to perhaps the things that they're saying. Whereas he's presenting characters who might better exemplify a way of being in the world
right.
that is more true to what it means to being a person who is good. The people who are supposed to know better don't.
Yeah, placing a premium definitely on innocence.
Mm-hmm.
So let me ask you, in Kronos, what doesn't work so well? Where are the flaws?
Yeah, I mean, I think the development of the supporting characters, as I already mentioned, is one of those things that he does improve upon, and I think he does do differently. I mean, I feel like it's nitpicking, but I do think that he just gets better at using the camera. I think the camera moves a lot, as it does in every one of his films. I mean, that's one of the things that he continues to do, is that the camera, like, and I think you said it earlier, which is right, like, he moves us through the film kind of by this operatic, slowly moving camera. But it feels way more intentional as his films continue.
Yeah.
There were some shots where it would move, and not in like a Michael Bay way, or just moving for the sake of moving.
Yeah, it just stresses out.
Yeah, it's still slow. It's still kind of, I don't know, like, where you're taking me and where I'm supposed to be in this scene. And it would kind of end up in the place I think he wants me to be, but I'm not sure, kind of in the in-between space.
Yeah.
So maybe now he's not as liberal in the time that it takes to kind of move me to where he wants me to be. There's some of that, that he was getting his aesthetic down. But otherwise, I felt like it was so del Toro in so many ways. But I'm curious, what did you see?
Yeah, I mean, I felt the movement of the camera was very intentional. I feel like later on, he just got better at it.
Okay.
I think the intention was there from the start. And I think some of that even comes with budget. He had more and more tools and better tools to get that fluidity down. There's still a little wobble around the edges now and then that is just, I mean, that,
like a
that
literal wobble.
Sometimes, you know, just really super subtle, but all stuff that can be forgiven when you think about the fact that, you know, he mortgaged his house and sold his van in order to make the movie, and they're doing what they can with what they have. When you look at Mimic as his sophomore film, where he's got a legit budget, it honestly kind of blew me away.
Hmm.
The solidity of the storytelling between his first and his second film. I'm more intrigued by the themes of Kronos than I was by Mimic. But anything that had yet to be ironed out in terms of like pure craft was so solid in Mimic. I don't even know how to describe it. You know, and it was a movie that did fine, you know, and it definitely took Guillermo to the next level in his career and all that. I mean, almost with a, not in the style of like the Coens, but with the solidity of like the Coens. Like, just like, you know, you watch a Coen Brothers movie and you're like, holy cow. I mean, just, there's no slosh. It's all just beat to beat exactly what it needs to be. And that's how I feel about most of his films. Mimic being one of them, quite frankly, even if the story itself was kind of eh. I think when he was finished with Kronos, he really went through that film with a fine-tooth comb and was just like, okay, I want to understand, what are the things that just didn't work quite as well, and I want to iron all that out. And he did. If nothing else, Guillermo del Toro is a perfectionist. I mean, you can tell.
Absolutely.
I don't know if he runs his sets in like a despotic way. I hope not. He doesn't seem like the kind of personality who would. He seems like the gentlest soul you could ever imagine, but...
Who wants to put you to sleep with his voice.
But there's just such perfection in his art direction. And, you know, even the moment when Jesus is walking through his destroyed antique shop.
Oh, yeah.
I gotta tell you, just like I'm looking at that as a director and or as an art director and looking at all the clocks and things like that, which is another theme running through the whole movie, broken glass and clocks and things like that. Frankly, a million reflective surfaces all angled so precisely so that you never see the camera crew behind in any of those reflective surfaces, even though there's just crap everywhere because it's a destroyed store. Like, I look at that and I'm just like, holy cow, man.
That's awesome.
That had to have taken some time and effort to get that to that place where you don't see one boom mic and you don't see one, you know, soft box and you don't see any cameras, you don't see any gaffers walking around in the background. It's really, really impressive. So I think it was just a tightening from there of the stuff that was already kind of there. And I don't even want to say embryonic form because he was pretty decently formed director even then.
That's cool. I appreciate your perspective on that.
So anyway, this is the place that we always get to. Guillermo del Toro, freshman film, Kronos, the vampire story that is not immediately evident as a vampire story, but of course it is. What do we think? You know, he's made a decent amount of films.
Right? He has, actually.
Yeah. Kronos. I don't know. Where is it?
If I'm going to break his filmography into thirds, I'd actually probably put it in the top third.
Oh, yeah?
I think I would.
Yeah.
You know, I can't help but think of, when I think of Guillermo del Toro, an Emily Dickinson quote, which is, if you're going to tell the truth, tell it slant. I think that's what he does, right? He's telling the truth, but he's telling it in like a slanted way. And using these old ways of telling stories, whether it's gothic, whether it's in the horror genre, the fairy tale, the folklore, he's trying to tell his truth. And I think he does actually a good job in doing that with this film.
Right.
And I think so. I would put in that top third of his films, like Shape of Water, and not in this order necessarily, but Shape of Water, Pan's Labyrinth, Kronos, I'd put there. I like what it's saying. And I think, yeah, I think people should see it.
Yeah. I think broadly, I agree with that. I don't think I would go so far as to say it's a completist film.
So you wouldn't?
I'd call it a completist film? I don't think so, no. Okay. I wouldn't. I think here's what I would say. If you're the kind of person that's going to go out and watch a vampire movie, you know, you're the kind of person who's just like, oh, I like Twilight. What's another vampire movie? I'd be like, I got a better movie than that.
Yeah, right.
Here's something with more interesting themes, a more unique take on that whole idea, something that's got a philosophical edge to it that I think leads to an interesting conversation. Now, granted, the craft, yeah, he was still honing it, but we see young Guillermo del Toro there. I think anyway, you know, we've talked about this with other filmmakers, you know, whether it's Spike Lee, who just, he, all the ingredients were there, right. even if he wasn't fully baked yet. And I think it's clearly the same with Guillermo. I mean, he was the rudiments of the filmmaker he would eventually become, which is really cool. No, it's not up there with Pan's Labyrinth or Shape of Water. It's, you know, there's miles of distance there, but I'm definitely going to watch it before Pacific Rim. Enjoyed it more than the Hellboy movies. I thought thematically was certainly more interesting than Mimic. All that's to say, of the Guillermo del Toro films that I've seen, I'm going to put it in the dead middle, quite frankly.
Okay.
Enjoyed it a lot. If nothing else, this whole exercise has made me want to go back and watch the whole Guillermo del Toro library, including all the stuff I haven't seen. I was really jazzed by it.
We haven't mentioned Blade 2, but still.
Blade 2, yeah.
There he is right there.
That's right, man. You know what? I didn't watch that one recently. I'd be curious to go back to that one.
Yeah, I didn't go back to it. Because when I was thinking about what films do I want to go back to with Guillermo del Toro, I felt like I want to go back to the films that seem most closely associated with Kronos, right? And I think that's telling.
Yeah.
Some of the ones that we didn't mention or talk about didn't feel like they were kind of connected in the same way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, all right, super. Clearly, we're two guys with affection for Guillermo del Toro. I'm thrilled that he not only has a Best Picture in his resume, but even more thrilled that he's got an Oscar on his shelf that says Best Director on it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. Fantastic material, without a doubt. You have to check out. If you haven't already, go watch it. Certainly, if you haven't already, you're going to go watch. You have to go watch Pan's Labyrinth, Shape of Water. Beautiful films. When you get done with those, Kronos, you could do a lot worse. It's weird. It's creepy. Might be up your alley.
I think so.
Already mentioned it, but I have to mention it again. I saw this film in the best way possible, and that is streaming it from Filmstruck.
So did I.
Fantastic, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, how many films this season have we seen because of Filmstruck?
I was thinking about that as a theme for this season, too, and there are a lot.
Yeah, and the fact that we can actually not just watch the film, but watch all the extras that are part of the Criterion DVD release of it, and audio commentary. If you want to get lulled into the arms of the Sandman like I was by the dulcet voice of Guillermo del Toro, man, you got to hear that commentary track. And as a bonus, he says a lot of really smart and really cool things.
But if you want to fall asleep, listen to the commentary track.
That's right. Filmstruck, don't hesitate. Some amazing films that you're missing out on if you don't use it. And speaking of Filmstruck, next month's film.
Yes.
Also available on Filmstruck.
So let's talk about that first. We don't have to go long. We need to talk about this briefly because it's our last episode of this volume.
This thing just snuck right up on us, really. I really didn't even see it coming. And I looked at my watch and I was like, holy cow, we're at the end of season two.
I can't believe it.
Yeah.
So the next episode.
It's a big one. Now, you probably recall, if you're a longtime Freshman 15 listener, that we ended season one on a big guy. Stanley Kubrick was our closer. I mean, you know, and you can't get much better than that.
But can we?
Can we? So, needless to say, I think we like to think big for our season closers.
Adventures in Babysitting.
We're going to leave the mystery. I don't know, Daniel. I've almost been, I don't want to say intimidated. I think next episode, episode 30, is quite frankly one of the reasons that we decided to do a season two. And I think it was our first decision. We're like, if we're doing season two,
we have to do this guy.
We're ending on this guy.
And this is one of my favorite filmmakers.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't wait.
If it's not already clear, you're just going to have to join us for episode 30, the end of season two. And you might be thinking, so is that the end of the Freshman 15? Because I know that was something you guys were discussing last time. I'm not going to leave you in suspense. Daniel and I are going to do more episodes.
Yeah, we want to.
Calm down.
It's part of us. We have to.
So no, this isn't the final. I don't see how we could do it. Even if we got down to like two listeners, I think we'd probably still want to do a third season.
Because we'd still have four listeners. That would include the two of us.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, by the way, most of the hits in our analytics are from Daniel and myself re-listening to our own episodes.
Oh, yeah, all
we're those
time.
Kind of guys.
Well, thanks for listening. If you want to get a hold of us, you can find us on Facebook, Instagram. You can email us at freshman15film@gmail.com. That's freshman15film@gmail.com. And hey, listen, if you have time, go on iTunes, find us, give us a rating. It helps other people find our podcast so that they can listen too.
Thanks so much for joining us. Until next time. I'm Jeremy Bear.
I'm Daniel Long.
Talk to you soon.
Later.